I want to start with a rather trivial illustration, if that's all right. Probably help me anyway. So I found... you know, they say that golf is one of the most frustrating sports in the world. Well, in my early 20s, I started playing golf, and I can tell you that that's very true. Sometimes you get a really kind of good hit on the ball, and it makes it goes flying. It's very satisfying, but then the very next shot can be terrible. And in my experience, you can spend more time in the bushes trying to find your ball than anything else. They say golf is the most sociable sport. Well, it is on the tee and at the green, and in between, who knows? You can spend hours apart from anyone else, you know, just living with the trees and the blackbirds. In fact, I was so frustrated, I almost gave up. But then I had a revelation. And if you're a golf player and you're frustrated with your playing, just take this tip. And I realised what the problem was. I thought I was better than I actually was. So every time I'd hit a good shot, I'd go, yes, that's more like it. Every time I'd hit a bad shot, I'd be despondent and say, where did that come from? And I realised that actually bad shots were normal. bad shots were normal, and a good shot was a bonus. And I changed my expectations. I realised my limits. I played within them. And it sounds simple, but it actually changed everything. It changed my enjoyment of the game. And I even think I began to get a bit better. Isn't that amazing? So changes of expectations, that is a trivial example, but I think it does highlight what can be true of the whole of life. Let me ask you this question. What do you expect life to be like? What are you expecting life to be like? If you can think about anything, why do you expect life to be like that? So I think generally we expect life to work out relatively well. We expect to live to an old age. We expect to be generally healthy. We expect to be able to recover from most of the illnesses we come our way. We expect to have friends, and I could go on. And any different then is painful, isn't it? And unexpected. You know, Ecclesiastes is a very realistic book, I found, certainly this week, and as I've been reading it and studying it over the last few months. It's a very realistic book. It's like a sermon from a teacher or a preacher to a people like us to kind of deconstruct an oversimplified way of looking at life. It's there, actually, to provide comfort, I think, for all those who are experiencing the sharp side of life. And it teaches us how to enjoy life within the limits that is given. It's a book that looks life straight in the eyes, with all its evil, all its good. And it teaches us to love life by embracing it for what it actually is, rather than what we would like it to be. Chapter 12, right at the end of the book, the book describes itself in these terms, as goads, as firmly embedded nails in the hand of one shepherd. Now, goads were sticks, right, with nails embedded in that a shepherd used to hit its sheep when they were going off course to keep it on track. Now, I'm not a sheep, but I imagine that really hurts your bottom, you know? As in, it's not pleasant, is it? It's painful. But actually, it's necessary to keep them on track. That, if you found Ecclesiastes so far this morning painful, well, that's doing the right thing. Because it's shaking us up from an oversimplified way of looking at life and saying, no, you don't go that way. Stick to the path. So that's what's happening here in these opening verses. I think they're here to teach us that we need to accept life's God-given limits. We're going to see several realities about life. Life is frustrating. Life is futile. Life is repetitive. But rather than kicking against it, if we embrace these God-given limits and the God who gives them, we'll see actually it's the only way to live. Let's have a think firstly about the fact that life is frustrating. Look at verse 1 with me. The words of the teacher, son of David, king of Jerusalem. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. It sounds quite hopeless, doesn't it? But it's actually the theme of the whole book. This is why he's written the book. The author ends in chapter 12, verse 8, in the same, more or less the same way. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Everything is meaningless. It's important then for us to get our heads around what he means by life being meaningless. And he clearly doesn't mean that there's no meaning at all in life. It can't mean that, can it? I mean, as we go through the book, you'll see that that's clearly not what he means. You know, he encourages us to enjoy life, to embrace it, to enjoy your wife if you've got one, to enjoy the food and the drink you've got. He's not saying there's no meaning, but what he is saying is this, that whatever meaning there is limited. That's true in our experience, isn't it? Try telling someone cradling their newborn baby that life is meaningless. Or someone who's on their wedding day, try telling them life is meaningless. Or the person who's just climbed Mount Everest or won the World Cup. Try telling them that life is meaningless. Try telling someone at the graveside of a loved one that that relationship was meaningless. There is meaning in all of these things. The problem is it just doesn't last. The Hebrew word behind meaningless, used elsewhere in the Bible, was translated breath or vapor or smoke, which is why we did the match thing earlier. What does he mean? Well, at least two things by this. Let me take you through those two things. Life is short. Psalm 39 verse 5 says about God, "You have made my days a mere handbreadth. The span of my years is as nothing before you. Everyone is but a breath," this word. "Even those who seem secure." How many breaths have you taken since you came in the room this morning? There was another one. Almost missed it, didn't you? Tiny, aren't they? That's life. Gone. A newborn baby's breath is like half the length, isn't it? The merest of breaths, says the teacher. The merest of breaths. The whole thing is just breath. For those of you who love Shakespeare, Macbeth said after hearing the death of Lady Macbeth these words, "Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time. And all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow. A poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage, and then is heard no more. It's a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing." I think he was onto something. I think you've been reading Ecclesiastes. Life is short. But it's also elusive. You can't control it. Often the teacher uses this word meaningless alongside another image. It comes in verse 14. We haven't read it this morning. But it's this, it's a chasing after the wind. When I was a child, I used to dream of what it would be like to fly in a plane and open a window and not get sucked out, because I didn't understand that at the time, but grab a cloud, and to kind of, take it home and to see what it was like. It's so like cotton wool, isn't it? But actually, I think I've understood now that if I open a window, that's pretty dangerous, which is why you can't open a window in a plane when you're couple of thousand feet in the air, you get sucked out. But even if I could grab a cloud, I couldn't, could I? I couldn't hold it, couldn't contain it. I can't. And if you've ever gone on a walk on a misty morning, try bottling up a bit of the mist and taking it home and showing whoever is that's at home. You can't do it. It's elusive. You can't control it. You can't hold on to it. It's real. It's there. You can see it. You can even smell some smoke, but you can't hold on to it. You can't grasp it. Life is like that. One book I've been reading on Ecclesiastes, which is worth reading, called Destiny, has this picture of a sandcastle on the front. And just behind the sandcastle is the sea just creeping its way up the beach. Peter Lightheart, who's written on Ecclesiastes, goes one step further. "Our projects are not sandcastles on the beach. That image for the preacher would suggest something far too solid and permanent. Our projects are cloud castles on a windy day. See, life is frustrating, isn't it? It doesn't last long, and we can't control it. We can't tell whether something will happen tomorrow to wash away our sandcastles. We can't predict the cancer diagnosis, the natural disaster, the accident. Frustration, frustration, says the teacher. All is frustration. But life's not only frustrating, it's futile, isn't it? It's hard work, just standing still. Verse 3. What do people gain from all their labours of which they toil under the sun? And this question comes throughout the book, actually, but particularly chapters 1 to 4, and it becomes the question. What's the point? What do you gain from all your work? It doesn't just mean, you know, if you don't work, as in paid work, you know, it doesn't mean that it doesn't apply. It just means that everything we're doing, like all the busyness of life, the things we're trying to achieve and get on top of, you know, all of that kind of stuff, what do we gain? What gain is there? And the answer implied and spelled out, as we'll go through, we'll see for sure, is nothing. We gain nothing. When all is said and done, in light of the fact that life is short and elusive, there's nothing left over for us. Life's hard work, and most of us don't end up with much at the end of it. And what we do have at the end is useless to us. You can't take it with you. As one man, Job, says in the Bible, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart." Perhaps you've heard the story, I don't know if it's true or not, of a man who was asked at his father's funeral, how much did he leave? To which his answer was, everything. He took nothing with him. He's left it all behind. At the end of the day, any gain is taken from us by death. See, we love progress, don't we? The idea of progress in our world. We love to, like, we've got to be going somewhere, achieving something, progressing. You know, maybe it's in your music lessons. I have all these parents often, you know, how's my child progressing? That's a fair question, you know. They're paying me lots of money to teach their children guitar. They want to see some progress. Business profits, sports teams, they're not progressing. We ditch the manager or something like that, don't we? Something has to change if there's no progress. We're obsessed with progress, aren't we? But actually, Ecclesiastes teaches us that for all our hard work, there's no gain, there's no profit. Second thing, I think this is really refreshing, so I really hope that this helps us, that actually this is all part of a normal human existence. See, the teacher uses this phrase, under the sun. What do people gain from all their labours of which they toil under the sun? And I think when I first read Ecclesiastes, I thought that meant life without God. In which case, Ecclesiastes, the man, was trying to work out what life was like without God in order to tell us that actually it's much better with God. He's looking at the secular worldview, but then commending theism or something like that. But actually, I don't think it is that, and I've been persuaded by several things I've read. One author explains like this. The phrase under the sun is more a temporal label, it's to do with time, rather than a spatial one, not to do with space. It refers to a now rather than a there. It means during this time that we have. It makes more sense, I think, to see the teacher, the preacher, exploring life within the bounds of time as a believer, grappling with life as it really is. And life is futile and frustrating whether you're a believer or not. Let me ask you, if you are a Christian, what should be your experience in this world we're in? Are we immune from its evils? Of course not. Christians get sick. Christians are killed in war. Christians are made redundant. Christians are caught up in accidents and cause accidents. Christians die. For some people in the world, becoming a Christian is the cause of their suffering. That's why they're suffering, because they've turned to Christ. Some people are rejected and shunned by family and friends. Some people lose their jobs. Some people are chased out of their homes and their countries even for turning to Christ. No, all this frustration is just all part of living life in the world under the sun. Now, I think this is really very freeing for us. I think it's freeing on a couple of counts. Firstly, I think it's freeing because we can stand side by side with people who are suffering. And we can say, we don't stand like over here and say, oh, come to Jesus and escape it all. We don't come and say, come over here because here everything is awesome. Everything is cool when you're part of a team. That's a reference to Lego Movie. We stand beside them and we say, everything isn't awesome, but come and hold on to our Saviour. You know, I think it's really, really helpful. We don't have to feel embarrassed or on the back foot when suffering comes, like we have to somehow defend God's reputation. We don't have to fight God's corner. At the end of the day, we live in a broken world, just alongside everybody else. I think it's also helpful because it means that we shouldn't be surprised when we suffer ourselves. We're not immune from suffering. It's okay as a believer to find life hard, to find life frustrating, to find it futile, and to find it perplexing. I think that's a very freeing truth. Now, some people, of course, respond to evil as if the presence of evil proves that God cannot exist. And, I've forgotten actually that at this point, sorry, Emmanuel Juniors are meant to be now escaping, sorry, not escaping, going to now think about what we've been thinking about already and to have a look ahead at some other things. I want us to think, just to carry on thinking along these lines. You know, some people respond to evil in very different ways, don't they? As if the presence of evil disproves the existence of God. Or they prove that, you know, God isn't loving, or he's loving but not powerful. But where does that leave us? Listen to Richard Dawkins. In a universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, I don't even understand what all that is, but just imagine that you do. Some people are going to get hurt. Other people are going to get lucky. You won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect. If there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no other good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference, DNA neither knows nor cares, and we dance to its music. Find that comforting? You know, would you be happy to sit at the side of someone's bed on the last days and just quote that to them? Of course not. It doesn't fit with our experience, does it? We feel evil. We feel injustice, and we hate it, don't we? It feels wrong, because there is a right. There is good. There is justice, and we want it. You know, the Bible is far more realistic. It affirms our experience that life is often hard, that suffering is real and evil, and at the same time that God is both loving and powerful and rules it. Ultimately, of course, the Bible tells us about a person, Jesus. God himself, who became flesh, took on our flesh, who took on the frustrations and everything else of this world, and who suffered and who died at the hands of wicked and cruel men. I've read this out before, but listen to what Tim Keller says about evil and suffering. Eastern religions say that suffering is an illusion. Other Western religions say that God's up there and has his reasons, but only Christianity, Bible-believing Christianity, has a God who has come himself into the world of suffering. Here's the thing, if God himself has suffered, then he must have reasons for allowing it to continue that aren't a matter of remoteness and distance. If God has himself experienced suffering, then he can be with you in the suffering. In the secular world, for you, who cares about suffering? The strong eat the weak and it doesn't matter. If you are morally outraged by it, say what? If you go to every other religion, the view of suffering is less poignant and immediate than the idea that God would come and get involved in this world's suffering. We see that, don't we, in the cross. Last thing I want to say, really, is that life is repetitive. Life is repetitive. We've seen that it's futile. We've seen that it's frustrating. But life is repetitive. And the teacher, the preacher at this point, points us to learn from various things, from nature, from experience, and from history. Let's have a look at nature. Verse 4, the sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. I don't know if you've ever watched one of those long distance runs. You know, it's 10,000 metres. That's apparently 25 times around the track. I don't know if you know that when the TV shows this, it shows you a couple of laps and it goes to something else, doesn't it? And it comes back about half an hour later and they're still going round and round and round and round 25 times. That sounds terrible to me. But the athlete, they set off and they run round, and that's the image here. They're just making another circuit. They're panting. That word, the Hebrew word, is like the sun is panting just to make another circuit. It's running round and round and round. It's been doing it for a long time. I've been alive 46 years. It was there 46 years before that, and it was the day before that, and day before that, and day before that, and day before that. And if I keep saying the day before that until I die, I won't get to when the sun started its course. That's how many times. And I think the point is this. You don't hear the sun complaining, do we? It's not like the sun, he's been doing it forever. And it continues to do it every day, the same course. You know, okay, it kind of changes, doesn't it, over 365 days. Don't get scientific with me too much. But the point is here that the sun doesn't, it's not like the sun has a 12-month review with God. Let's just have a little chat about how you've performed. You don't hear the sun go, it's a bit hot up here actually, can I have some fans against health and safety? The sun just does its job. The sun goes round and round and round. Well, actually it doesn't, does it? The earth goes round the sun. But from our perspective, that's what it looks like. That's east to west. What about north to south? Look at the verse 6. The wind blows to the south and returns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. Verse 7, the water cycle, whatever it's actually called. I got this wrong last time I spoke to Bex, but anyway, it sounds to me like a water cycle. All streams flow into the sea, and yet the sea is never full to the places the streams come from. There they return again. What progress is the wind making? What progress is the sea and the rivers making? How are they kind of, what gain are they getting? They're not, they're just doing round and round and round again. It's like repetition and monotony are kind of built into the fabric of creation. And the teacher is saying, what makes you think your life is meant to be any different? Look at the world around you. This is what life is meant to be like. Repetitive. Monotonous. And that does fit our experience, doesn't it? I don't know if you remember this song. It's probably a bit old for most of you. Round like a circle within a spiral, like a wheel within a wheel. Never ending or beginning. Or an ever-spinning reel, like a snowball down a mountain, or a carnival balloon, like a carousel that's turning, running rings around the moon, like a clock whose hands are sweeping past the minutes of its face, and the world is like an apple whirling silently in space, like the circles that you find in the windmills of your mind. Keys that jingle in your pocket, words that jangle in your head. Why did summer go so quickly? Was it something that you said? Lovers walking along the shore and leave their footprints in the sand. Is the sound of distant drumming just the fingers of your hand? Pictures hanging in the hallway and the fragment of a song. Half-remembered names and faces, but to whom do they belong? When you knew that it was over, you were suddenly aware that the autumn leaves were turning to the colour of her hair. Like a circle in a spiral, like a wheel within a wheel, never ending or beginning on an ever-spinning reel. as the images unwind, like the circles that you find in the windmills of your mind. Life's repetitive, isn't it? Like a wheel within a wheel. Round and round and round. Monday follows Sunday. Monday mornings follow night. Breakfast follows dinner. Most of us, we're prone to the Monday blues, aren't we? You know, school's hard, isn't it? After 2 weeks off, whatever. We hate, in some sense, the routine. We constantly want to break free from it. But we can't. We're in it. That's what life is like. Perhaps we should learn a lesson from the world around us. Repetition and monotony is normal. Let's learn to embrace it. Second thing is that we learn from experience. And you can see the kind of ache for satisfaction, can't you, in verse 8. All things are wearisome. More than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. The famous song, I Can't Get No Satisfaction. Or another one you might not know, Wassy Diop, Everything is Never Quite Enough. They had it all, didn't they? These pop stars, from one point of view, the money, the attention, the pleasure, but everything is never quite enough. Sure, there might be satisfying moments, like eating a great meal, drinking a glass of wine at the end of a really hard day, or a cool drink on a hot day, but it all just comes round again. I quite often go walking around here, and there's this, this one particular view that when the first time I saw it, I was just like stunned by it. I've done it lots of times since, and I don't now think very hard about it. But I was with someone else recently who was there for the first time and said, wow, what an amazing view. And I thought, yeah, it is. And I've just ignored, my eye had had enough. You know, it's always wants the next thing, doesn't it? Why can't I be looking at that same view again for the 500th time and still be in awe? The eye never has enough of seeing. The ear never has enough of hearing. So the ache for satisfaction, the obsession with novelty. Verse 9, what has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new. It was here already. Long ago, it was here before our time. In music, there's a certain chord sequence. I teach kids guitar, and they come with these pop songs they want to learn. Do you know what? They are all the same. Right? And they sound very different and unique. There's four chords. It's a 1-5-6-4 chord sequence. It always happens. I could play it to you, and you'd recognize about 20 songs instantaneously. There's a YouTube video where this band have strung together 20 songs, just playing the same chord sequence and singing the lyrics. It sounds inventive. It sounds new, but there's nothing new under the sun. It's just those four chords. You know, they might be in a slightly different order sometimes. But at the end of the day, think about it, music, just playing with what's already there. Isn't it? There's nothing new. It's all recycled. And yet our culture is obsessed, isn't it, with everything that's the latest, whether it's the phone, car, TV, music, the latest technique for doing tidying your house. But nothing really new, is there? People have been doing it for centuries. We've just got loads more clutter than they used to. Thirdly, finally, learning from history. Verse 11, no one remembers the former generations, and even those yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow them. We might remember our parents or grandparents. Some of us maybe even know a bit further back than that, but you know, you're going to struggle to go much, much further back, aren't you? But nobody's going to remember us, not properly, not much. If we want to remember, we've got to work really hard. That's why we have Poppy Day, isn't it, every year? Because, you know, we mustn't forget, because we're prone to forget, because life moves on. That's why we remember the 5th of November. You know, books are written about past figures to bring them to life. I've just read an autobiography of Johnny Bairstow, the cricketer, and it's basically an attempt to bring his dad's life back for us all to see and to appreciate. It's more for him than for us, really. Sports stands are named after famous people, aren't they? The Kevin Keegan stand. Well, I still know who he is, but some people in a few years' time will be thinking, what on earth is that stand doing there? Let's rename it. He remembers them. Now, we might think at this point in Ecclesiastes, okay, can we have a little bit of relief now? You know, why are you telling us all this stuff? Where does it leave us? What is the preacher's point? We don't really see it here in verses 1 to 11 that much. Well, you're going to have to come back to hear the next 11 sermons on it. But let me give you an impression of where we're going. You see, there is another perspective that the teacher also has. Sure, we live now, life under the sun. We live life now. But there is a not yet. There is a not yet. And the Bible teaches us this throughout. There's a not yet where frustration will be removed, where our work will be fruitful, not futile, where we'll never be bored but satisfied, where there'll be no more pain, no more tears, no more injustice, no more sickness, no more sadness. And here's the question I just want to leave us with this morning. Just imagine, what if all this frustration is on purpose? What if this is what life is meant to be like? What if God's designed it this way? What if God knows that we are so prone to pride, that we are so prone to thinking that we can live life and do life without him, that he has frustrated life? If you know the story of Babel, I was reading to my kids a couple of days ago. People trying to build a tower to reach heaven. God confuses their language. Now, why did he do that? Did he think they could actually reach heaven? Of course not. But he knew that actually they were proud. They were prone to pride. God frustrated their attempts by getting them to speak different languages. Because he knew the pride of our hearts. He knew we were so prone to thinking that we can live without him. So he's frustrated our attempts. What if God has done this so we'll give up our projects? We'll give up seeking for novelty. We'll give up seeking satisfaction apart from him. What if this is all on purpose to teach us to fear him? Let me close with some words that Paul wrote in Romans chapter 8. I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. The creation waits in eager expectation for the children of God to be revealed. For the creation was subjected to frustration. That's this word, meaningless. The creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, God, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the freedom and glory of the children of God. We know, and we do know this, don't we, that the whole creation has been groaning, as in the pains of childbirth, right up to the present time. Not only so, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, Christians, we ourselves groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for our adoption to sonship, the redemption of our bodies. For in this hope, we are saved. But hope that is seen is no hope at all. Who hopes for what they already have? But if we hope for what we do not have, we wait for it patiently. God has subjected this world and our experience in this world to frustration in order that we might place our hope in the place and the person who has done away with all of that, so that one day we can live in the new creation, where, as I've said already, there is no more pain, there is no more tears, there will be no more frustration, there will be no more sickness, no more death, no more of what is frustrating about this life.